Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, where you find us on site at the US Open, Flushing Meadows, the Billie Jean King National Tennis Centre for the first time in 2023. And more specifically, you find us, myself, Catherine Ritiker, Matt Roberts and David Law, overlooking a outside court where right now the whooping and hollering that you hear prominently in the background is for Matt Roberts.
For the artist formerly known as Victoria Kuzmova.
They are loving whatever she's doing, and presumably her opponent as well. They're sharing the adoration. But honestly, I just came back from getting us a couple of beers for this podcast recording, and I heard this enormous ovation go up, and I thought, wow. Who's that for?
It's suddenly all happening here, isn't it?
And then I saw the name and I thought, where do I know that name? And then I realised it's the new name of Victoria Kuzmova, and it all came full circle. And over on the huge stage that they erect for Fan Week here outside the very front of the Arthur Ashe Stadium, Nicholas Jarry is currently being interviewed. Matt.
Honestly, you guys are lucky I'm here.
I feel very privileged.
Matt is absolutely in his element. I mean, we all are. It's good to be back, isn't
it? Yeah, and the fun doesn't stop there, because I just saw, as we came and sat down in our position here in the media cafe, walking head down, looking massively focused, Kevin Anderson charging out towards the qualifying court, where he's currently 3-2 down against Thomas, or 3-2 up against Thomas Mahach.
Best player in the world.
Yeah. So all of our little favourites, plus a returning runner-up from a few years ago, looking ultra-focused.
I thought you were calling Kevin Anderson one of our favourites then. I mean, I have no negative feelings whatsoever about Kevin Anderson. I just wouldn't quite perhaps go that far.
Just don't have any feelings whatsoever.
Good luck to him. I wish him very well indeed. Yeah, look, we are absolutely delighted to be back. We've been delighted to be at Media Day today, speaking to all the runners and riders ahead of the tournament. That will be the main focus of this show. We all did a little event last night, didn't we? A sort of a Q&A with a few guests, organised by one of our listeners, lovely Greg, who has been a guest editor before for us and will be a guest editor again. And one of the questions we got, and that we have answered lots of times before, is what's your favourite slam? And Matt Roberts summed it up perfectly by saying, our favourite slam is the one that's on, and therefore the one that we're at. And it is with that in mind that I bring you news of our sponsor for the US Open. The Tennis Podcast during the US Open is brought to you in partnership with AO Travel, who operate the travel program for the first Grand Slam of the calendar year, the Australian Open. It's the next slam after this one. Each year, AO Travel brings thousands of tennis fans from across the world to Melbourne Park to witness world-class tennis and soak up one of the world's most livable cities. Melbourne loves to call itself that, doesn't it?
And it, you know, normally I wouldn't use that word to describe anywhere, but actually it feels very apt when I think about Melbourne, because if ever I were to relocate, I could definitely imagine myself...
Please don't, David.
We're quite committed to this.
We're running a business here. Although Max Rushton has somehow pulled it off, hasn't he?
I could definitely imagine myself living in Melbourne in another life.
I could imagine you there too. You know...
He's
a
man that suits a town.
You're always in your element at a tennis event. But yeah, I always think of you... living it up in Melbourne whenever we're there.
Well, look, I'm not necessarily suggesting you all move to Melbourne, but if you would like to go to Melbourne,
oh, yes, please,
for the Australian Open, AO Travel can take care of your flights, premium accommodation, tournament tickets and behind-the-scenes experiences. You just need to pack your bags. I mean, it says that as if that's an easy thing to do. That's... God, if somebody could operate a travel company that did the packing for you, take my money. Pack your bags and get ready for an incredible trip down under. Based in the heart of the sporting capital of the world, in Melbourne, AO Travel have the local knowledge and expertise to deliver an unforgettable experience. With insider knowledge of the best restaurants, bars and family-friendly experiences in the city and surrounding regions. And new for 2024... they've also introduced their luxurious AO Travel Lounge to their premium packages, a space for you to wine, dine, and generally elevate your AO experience. So go to ozopentravel.com to see what they have to offer and book yourself the tennis trip of a lifetime. And I know what is happening right now as he listens to it. My dad is typing ozopentravel.com into his browser. And the good news for my dad is that AO Travel are offering Friends of the Tennis Podcast a $500 Australian discount off any premium lounge package. So if you're a Friends subscriber, look out for our Friends newsletter over the weekend for details, or write to us at friends@tennispodcast.net and we can send you the discount code to use. So thank you, AO Travel, for being a part of our US Open experience. It always lessens the post-US Open come down to already have one eye on Melbourne in January. But most of our eyes right now are on New York in August/September, and today they've been on the press conference room, which started with dog today. I can legitimately lead with dog.
Tell us more.
Yes, there were 2 points of the day where Catherine was at her brightest, I would say. They were Daniil Medvedev at the end of the day, as always. He was a joy in the media room, and it was the dog to start the day.
Yeah, look, media day was advertised to be between the hours of 11 and 3. It neither started at 11 nor finished at 3, but it did at least start with a dog and end with Daniil Medvedev. So swings and roundabouts on media day, folks. Actually, the dog wasn't quite first up. It was Francis Tiafoe that was first in, wasn't he? But I would like to lead with the dog, because Jessica Pegula this week is sponsoring a trainee veteran support dog, and as part of that sponsorship awareness raising program, Ace the trainee dog is accompanying her everywhere she goes, and that includes into the press conference room. And actually the best aspect of this was the whole point of the training is for... Hello and welcome to the Dog Podcast. The whole point of the dog training program is that they get used to any and every type of situation. So they brought Ace. Ace's handlers came into the press conference room, and there was about a 20-minute period where Ace was just taking it all in, being encouraged to sit on the players' seats, having photos of herself taken.
Catherine took their business card.
I took Ace's business card quite hastily. Yep. You'll be surprised to hear there's quite a lot of ace content on our Instagram.
Sudden flurry.
Yeah. And then once Ace was comfortable, Jessica Pegula then entered the room. And I know what you're all thinking. Why were you so hard on Ash Barty for having a baby in the room and not so harsh on Jessica Pegula for having a dog in the room? Because it's my podcast, is the answer. I can't logically explain it. I know it's probably not quite right. I don't know. But I was having a low moment and the universe sent me a dog. So, great.
Yeah. I also think, I mean, I don't want to be too serious about it, but there's a difference between previewing the tournament and reacting to a significant loss, is how I felt at the time. I mean, look, it's a long time ago now. Maybe it wasn't as big a deal as I felt it was at the time, but I still generally stand by that. But actually, I think what this did enable Pegula to do was just have something else to talk about, for a start. And she is somebody who's... She doesn't get the attention that others of her ranking from the United States have had in the past, I don't think, men or women. But I think she's making herself impossible to ignore, which I think is I'm pleased about the way she just goes about her business. And she sat down and the first thing she said was sort of, I don't feel that different to last year because I was kind of a runner and rider last year. It's always the same. These type of press conferences are always the same. And you know, and until the question came about the quarterfinals, and she just said, I've just got to win one. What am I working on? I've just got to win it. I mean, it's not like there's not some master plan. I've been close to winning one of those matches. She didn't seem to be making much of that.
See, I had a slightly different take on all of that. Sorry, Matt, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say that I'm always torn on when players say something like treating each match the same, because that hasn't been working for Jessica Pegula. It almost feels like she does need to treat those quarterfinals differently. Like
that was exactly my take.
And
yeah.
And I think it's really good that she is generally unaffected by it. Like, I don't think, and I'm sorry that whenever I seem to open my mouth on this podcast, Maria Sakkari seems to catch some strays, because I'm always bringing her up to sort of illustrate my point. But I feel like Sakkari is deeply affected by the sort of baggage that she's built up, and it has sort of ended up seeping into her tennis generally, and she's become a less consistent force in the sport than she was a couple of years ago. Jessica Pegula is taking these quarterfinal hits, but it's not actually sort of knocking her or affecting her at all generally. And I find that really impressive. But I do think that when it gets to the quarterfinal stage, something does need to change for her. And maybe it is a question of treating the match a little bit differently to others, rather than just sort of thinking, oh, maybe I'll get there eventually because, you know, the odds suggest that I will. You know, I don't know. I'm kind of torn about how I feel about all that.
I felt I would take it even further than that. I got the impression, and this is something we always look out for, and it rings alarm bells for us generally when we hear this. I got the impression she doesn't treat slams differently enough to tour level events. And this is a precarious balance, because I really support players supporting the tour and recognising the importance of that. And she does have a prominent position on the WTA Players Council. You know, I appreciate that she's not just treating the tour as a means to prepare for the big events, but equally, you need to elevate for these big events. You need to bring something different. You need to bring a different attitude. And she was asked about her confidence levels coming in here. Like, this must be the most confident you've ever felt coming into a slam, having won that title in Canada. And she said, no, I don't feel particularly confident. I don't feel unconfident. But she described how she felt as typical. How I feel in a typical week. She said, it's a new week. It's new challenges. That's the attitude that has got me to where I am.
That's
it. But it's also the attitude that I think is holding her back. And that, yeah, maybe she has to be prepared to sacrifice some consistency in order to maximise at the slams, because by total contrast, Sabalenka was asked later on in the day very directly about whether her approach to tour events has switched, has changed since she became a Grand Slam champion. And she said, absolutely it has. She said she views them now, since becoming a Slam winner in Australia, as more preparation for Slams.
That's interesting.
And that's obviously extreme, and that maybe is not great to hear from a tour perspective, but she's a Grand Slam champion and Jessica Pegula isn't.
Yeah, although she did say that she'd sort of only changed it after winning the Australian Open, and it hasn't actually had a sort of huge effect on her Slam performances. You know, she's kept up that thing of losing from winning positions in semi-finals. But I agree. I find it so fascinating when a player's greatest strength, and I think Pegula's consistency and level-headedness is kind of her greatest strength, can also be something that can sort of hold you back. I always think it's very difficult for a player when that is the case, because how do you juggle and balance those two things? But it does strike me that Pegula is now in a place where, yeah, elevating at Slams needs to be the goal.
There was some Buffalo Bills chat. Apparently she spoke to the team.
Yeah, there were some good photos of that with her. Look, frankly, she looked like the head coach.
Yeah.
Was just talking to them, addressing them, and they were really listening and concentrating on what she got to say. And she was asked about why it is that athletes from different sports like each other's company. And she went really granular with the answer about how kind of little we see of what goes on. You know, she said that the match play, the wins, are the reward for everything that you have to go through. She said she reckoned in the last couple of weeks she'd done 22 half-an-hour warm-ups for practice, which it's so...
Sounds tedious.
Boring, yeah. It's tedious, it's relentless, and you've just got to do it. There's no real shortcut, there's no way around that if you want to be the best you can be. I mean, I think that's... Some players like Kyrgios have found just the sheer tedium of doing that difficult to do. And she won't miss out anything, but I think it is a little window into their lives.
I appreciated that granular detail, actually, because it's always alluded to how hard the sport is, the rigors of training, the demands, but that's a lot harder for us to get our teeth into. That's very conceptual, isn't it? We know in the abstract that it is really difficult. We know in the abstract how tedious the life of a tennis pro can be, and yet it feels quite different. As soon as she described the half-hour warm-ups, I thought, that sounds god-awful. There is no amount of money you could pay me. I mean, obviously, that's not true. But I'm exaggerating for effect, but it really does sound utterly mind-numbing. And I appreciated that. I appreciate the gym videos that Maria Sakkari and various other players post, you know, actually seeing what it takes. Oh, I find that important.
Yeah, watching Cincinnati, it was the other week, they kept cutting to the feed of the player gym, sort of backstage pre-match. I could watch that feed on a loop for hours. I found it fascinating, all the different exercises they're doing, and you know, Carlos Alcaraz is doing all these sorts of things to, I don't know, strengthen his wrists or whatever it is, and then suddenly he's having a bit of downtime and he's playing a bit of temping bowling. It's sort of a temporary temping bowling thing in the gym while Daniil Medvedev's trying to stretch in the corner. Like, I find that all fascinating. I don't feel like we see enough of that. I felt like, you know, maybe the Netflix show could have shown more stuff like that. You know, personally, I tuned out in the Netflix show when they started showing match footage, because I see that all the time. If I'm going to a documentary to tell me more about the sport, I want it to be stuff that I don't see. And I think, you know, the actual hours and input that these players have to put into their sport to get as good as they are, I think that's fascinating. And generally, they're quite reluctant to actually talk about it because they feel like they might be giving up an edge or whatever. And, you know, so it was... I did really appreciate Pegula sort of going into that detail.
Something else that Jessica Pegula was content to talk about to a certain extent while others were reluctant to was the big Saudi Arabia question that, as we mentioned on yesterday's Draw Day show, we expected to be a hot topic of questioning, at least, perhaps not of answering today, with the rumours that Saudi Arabia have made the highest financial bid to host the WTA finals of this year. I think every female player that came through the press conference room today was asked how they felt about that. I don't think any of the male players were asked about the next gen finals confirmed as being staged in Jeddah later this year, and actually the fact that the Saudi Arabia bid for the WTA finals is just that, a bid, was what was being used today as the get out of jail free card by almost all of the WTA players. Their answer was, nothing's confirmed yet, I can't possibly have an opinion on something hypothetical, because that's
rumours they were
yeah,
using the word.
And that will hold for a while, probably not that long. But it's not going to hold forever. But Jessica Pegula was one of those, and perhaps her position on the Players' Council contributed to this, was one of those that was prepared to at least give an answer that illustrated a little of how she feels about things. Now, I wish she felt a little differently about things or had a bit more to say, but in the context of how unprepared anyone else is to even touch upon the complexities and moral maze that this presents, let alone state a position on them, in that context, she was impressive today.
Yeah, I would say
so. She cleared a very low bar.
Yeah, and that bar is, as you said, acknowledge the issues, recognise that this is bigger than tennis and this is bigger than money, and mention those issues. And I think she made an interesting point about the fact that she would only feel comfortable playing there if somewhere written into some sort of contract or whatever, you know, we don't know the details, I suppose, there is some requirement for change in Saudi Arabia, was basically what she was saying. And that might be absolutely impossible to achieve, you know, certainly the WTA Tour and the ATP Tour have been in Qatar for many, many years, and I don't think there's been a huge amount of sort of change there. But if written into the contract was some sort of metrics of change that the tour needs to see happening in Saudi Arabia to stay there, then, you know, tennis would be doing some sort of good. I think that was generally her point. I think that's going to be very, very difficult to achieve. But I did at least really respect that she wanted to say that, and I hope that as a member of the council as she is, she will be putting that forward in all the meetings that she's in with the WTA, and we'll see. But it was a grown up answer, I thought, from Pegula, and I was, you know, particularly impressed that she didn't just dodge it in the way that literally everyone else did.
And it's obviously incredibly complex, because something else that she was asked about, and a lot of the WTA players was asked about, was equal prize money. This year, the tournament is celebrating the 50th anniversary of awarding equal prize money to men and women. Obviously, we're extremely far from equal prize money across the board at tour level. And, you know, the point was made that the WTA has a lot less luxury than the ATP. It's in financially far more dire straits than the ATP, and look, I'm very conscious of that when I take the position I do on Saudi Arabia, and feel as demoralised as I do at the prospect of the WTA going there, because I want the WTA to be able to offer equal prize money, and I know they do too, and they will say, to be able to do that, we have to follow the money. That's what Billie Jean King urges women's sport, urges everybody to do, follow the money. And there's a point to be made there, and it's incredibly, incredibly complex. But I still leave today feeling really dejected and downcast about that situation within the sport.
Her answers were, I think, the platform for what the PR announcement will be if they end up going into business with Saudi Arabia. It'll be some sort of, there will be some sort of move to create, whether it's a fund or an involvement of women in Saudi Arabia that they can point to, that because they have to have something to say that they're addressing this and doing some good. How legitimate and far-reaching and relevant that is will be difficult to ascertain, I think, is the problem, because you can dress these things up. But that's, the ground is being laid for that right now. I think the question mark will be whether overall they decide that, I mean, it was interesting having Markéta Vondrousova in the interview room saying she would love it to be in Prague, you know, and that there, from the reporting of John Wertham, there is a bid in from Prague. It's just not as much money as Saudi Arabia. So given there are wider goals of one equal prize money and some of the financial difficulties the WTA is in, what do they do? Do they chase the money at every cost, or do they go for something like that? I mean, I would love to see it in Prague and have full crowds and all the rest of it, but
what are we doing wrong as a world and as a people where the most enticing finance, the only people, entity prepared to invest wholeheartedly in women's sport is a state which thoroughly devalues women, like,
yeah,
that situation makes me despair somewhat. Yeah, it's thoroughly demoralising. And P.S. Sorry, we will move on to chirpier things, but that is not the situation regarding women in Saudi Arabia is far from the only human rights abuse going on there. It's a country where homosexuality is illegal, and there is the very real prospect that Daria Kasatkina, an openly gay female player, qualifies for the WTA finals. That's not being talked about, and I hope it will be, and will be part of the people talking about it. But there is just, there's so much at play here and so much at stake,
and there's a premium on talking about it right now, because it's nearly September and we don't know where the WTA finals is going to be played. And I think it was Iga Świątek who complained that when it was held in Fort Worth last year, they were told that in the first event of this year, they would know where it's going to be. Or at the start of this year, they would know where it's going to be. And here we are, 9 months in, virtually, into the calendar, and we still don't have an announcement. That's so far from ideal.
Yeah, and Iga Świątek made the point that, and this was one of the things a few things I was pleased to hear in relation to an answer to this question, was she said she really wants to play Billie Jean King Cup.
Yeah.
For Poland this year, but she can't commit to it because she doesn't even know when the WTA finals are, let alone where. And that is a look, I know that's not the situation the WTA want to be in either. It's far from ideal for them, but it's extremely suboptimal. And it does need to be resolved. Iga Świątek, there wasn't a huge amount to take, I don't think, from what she had to say today. Did anybody
happier with
read
the balls.
Between any lines? Mm. Happier with the balls, yes.
Well, it was her that I think sort of led the charge for them to change. They've gone from the regular duty Wilson balls to the extra duty Wilson balls that they're using this year, so the same as the men basically now. And she says they're more durable, they fly less, they're easier to control in these conditions. I mean, of course this all comes with the sort of irony that she ended up winning the tournament last year, and you know, we'll obviously see how she gets on this year. I was absolutely astonished that the world number one didn't know that they were bringing in sort of video review for this tournament on several of the courts. Like, how does that message not get through? Is that tennis not doing enough to push that message, or is that just a sort of another example of Iga Świątek being totally in her own sort of bubble, and anything outside of, you know, forehands and backhands and some, a bit of, you know, strategy or whatever, and fitness, and, you know, everything that she can control, everything else being sort of not something that she's wants to think about or is prepared to think about. I don't know. I found it bizarre. Like, I can't imagine another sport where, you know, quite a genuinely important thing is coming in and, like, the top athlete is like, huh? I don't know.
That actually was weird. I suppose in football you sometimes see a player's misunderstanding of what the laws of the game are.
But, like, quite a niche... But that would be a niche thing.
Yeah.
Like, this is... A big
what is it again? The video replays are for double bounces, so that a player can they actually get three challenges, don't they? Like they used to with the Hawkeye, for things like double bounces.
Exactly, so that the umpire can just have a look to tell, you know, something that it's tough to tell in real time, double bounces or, I don't know, double hit, or whether you touch the ball at the net. Yeah, like things that are just difficult to pick up on in real time. Here at the US Open this year, that technology is going to be available on certainly all the main courts and some of the others as well. I think it's a good move. It's something they've trialed at the Next Gen Finals in the past, and everyone agreed it worked, and then it didn't come in, but the US Open have brought it in. And yeah, I don't know. I just found it weird. If, you know, just I can't really imagine, like, I don't know, the captain of Man United or something being like, huh, are we using VAR today?
It's, I mean, a lot of communication appears to take place on whether it's a player intranet or a email going out, and I'm just,
I
not,
don't think Świątek's spending a lot of time on the intranet.
No. Don't think so. And I mean, look, I'd like to think really they go around to the players and brief them on stuff like that, but also I think sometimes when it comes from a Grand Slam, they just do stuff. They don't necessarily, like, the tours and the players often seem to find out when we do.
Which is such a weird thing about tennis, isn't it? Because on one hand, I have this feeling of, nothing will ever change. We talk about all these things that feel like absolutely no-brainers to us to change about the sport, to improve it. But then in the back of all of our minds, we're thinking, yeah, but it never will, because it is tennis and there's the G7. There are seven entities that have to agree on anything for even the tiniest change to happen or stance to be taken. But then on the other hand, you have Grand Slams just every now and then doing whatever the hell they want without notice. Yeah. You know, the French
Open.
Looking
at you, Roland Garros.
French Open moving to October. And
I mean, it's interesting. I think there are some players that would be very... I think this is another... No, but the problem is they're not that reachable for tournaments. I mean, a guy like Eric Butarek, who works behind the scenes here, or they've got Jamie Baker at Wimbledon and Laura Robson now, people that are in touch with players. How many of them have direct contact to Iga Świątek? How available is she? Because I would imagine not very, because she doesn't want to be.
Busy playing Lego.
I think her life is simplified, her career is simplified, by not having too many people in it, I would imagine, and then for you, you've got to go through various people in order to get any message across. But I suspect other players are probably more reachable.
Interesting.
I could barely
just
hear
guesses.
Portions of that answer, David, over the sound of roars for what's her new name?
Victoria Runkakova.
And how's she getting on as we speak?
We're in a deciding set tiebreak.
The drama.
Wow. Do keep us posted, Matt.
Oh, I will.
Coco Gauff. David, you had an interesting question for Coco Gauff about Brad Gilbert, or I get the impression she really wants us to call him BG.
Yes, I think it's like he wants to be called BG as well. That's what Andre Agassi always used to call him. Yeah, I was really just... I was aware, in a way, that she has now been racking up the tournament wins and successes, or at least runs, since Wimbledon, and has probably answered this question more than once, you know, at these tournaments. I just haven't been at any of them, and so I wanted to know from her what she's hearing from her new coaching team that she hadn't really heard before they joined. And bless her, she didn't give me the Alexander Zverev, well, go and read my previous transcript answer, which I could have got. She actually engaged with it, and she, I think the main thing she was saying is it's coming from him. The fact that the message that he's giving is not necessarily groundbreaking information, but he has earned the right to be heard and listened to and respected because of what he's done in the game, the people he's coached, the way, and I also think the way he delivers a message. Mm. You know?
Honestly, sounds like she's just getting David Law
voice notes.
Yeah. That's what when I heard that answer, I was like, oh, she's just employed a David Law.
Mm. Yeah, because she said the sport is not as serious or as important in reality as it is in my mind. And Brad Gilbert has a way of relaxing her, I think. And I find that really quite sort of sweet in a way, because I think I don't think the Venn diagram of interests that Coco Gauff and Brad Gilbert have is much bigger than tennis. Like, I don't think Brad Gilbert knows about TikTok, and I don't think Coco Gauff knows about the bands that Brad Gilbert talks about.
I also don't think if we polled, how many people are there in this media garden? 10? And all of them will know who BG is. If you polled them all and said, describe Brad Gilbert in 3 words, I don't necessarily think relaxing would appear on the Venn diagram very prominently.
Right, no, that probably is true, but he just has a way of relaying these messages.
He's
as David
not anxious.
Said.
He's not anxious in the coaching box. He's not anxious around. He's been there and he's done it,
and he believes in her.
Yeah,
yeah.
He's seen the best of her, and he's just trying to get her to be that.
Yeah, he believes in her, and Gauff recognizes that the fact that he believes in her means that she should believe in herself because of the guys that he's coached.
Validating
before.
We all need external validation.
Yeah. Yeah, there's something quite sweet about the fact that these two totally different people, you know, share the common language of tennis. Mm. And he is able to tap into Coco Gauff's mind and translate his ideas in a way that do get across to her. I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, I agree. I still haven't done my predictions, but I do have a feeling I'm going to end up picking Coco Gauff to win this title. Maybe, possibly.
Interesting.
I had that feeling last night after the draw, and nothing about today has changed that feeling.
Yeah, I can understand why. I think I've never believed in her more than I do right now, but I'm not a massive believer in the success in the lead-up being replicated at the Grand Slam.
Yeah. You're very consistent with that.
My feeling is that Carlos Alcaraz will turn around the Djokovic defeat and win this. My feeling is that, and they'll meet in the final, and my feeling is that Iga Świątek will turn around that match from
That's
a week
it.
Or
like,
so
is,
ago.
Is 7 wins in favour of Świątek, does that matter more than one most recent win in favour of Coco Gauff?
No, I feel like it doesn't.
Yes, though, David. Like, that history that Świątek's got against Coco Gauff, we can't just disregard that just because Coco Gauff got one win. Like, Świątek has shown that she does dominate that matchup.
I do agree with your point, David. And obviously, I think we need a Brunker Kovar update, Matt.
Terrible news, but my internet's gone down.
I think someone might have won.
Was Runkakova winning a point?
No, it's 7-all.
Okay, wow.
Right,
first to 10, everyone.
That's why the rule was. Anyway, they probably thought it was a match point being saved there, didn't they? Bless them. What was I going to say? I do agree with your general point, David, and I obviously got my fingers burned on the clay this year, reading too much into results in the lead-up tournament, Runa, Medvedev, all of that. But it's the combination of the form with the Brad Gilbert, because Brad Gilbert has got people to do this swing, to use Canada and Cincinnati and take it into the US Open.
Yeah. Oh, there's a lot of evidence to push. I've not seen her come into this tournament, like I say, with me believing in her more, but also that you can see this frisson of excitement around her within the American media here. They all believe that this is happening, and she is being held up as the American hope, the player who is going to contend for this title. And I haven't seen that around her before. And I think Brad Gilbert does add some additional legitimacy to it. I just feel like, do you beat Iga Świątek twice in a row? I may change my mind about that. I've changed my mind before, even in Grand Slams, as they've gone along. But right now, I don't think Świątek is going to be the same player she was in Cincinnati. I think Goff could play. It still was really close at the end. I think Goff could play really well and lose. That is quite possible against, because Iga's that good.
One of the tennis sliding door moments of 2023 for me is, what if Goff had beaten Kenin in the first round of Wimbledon? It feels like that loss could end up being, maybe this is a conversation for if and when Coco Gauff wins this US Open, but could be completely defining for her, a real crossroads in her career. I don't think she'd be working with Brad Gilbert right now if she hadn't lost round one of Wimbledon.
It was certainly the result that Jessica Pegula cited, wasn't it? You know, everyone was asked kind of about Coco Gauff, and Pegula obviously being her doubles partner was one of them. And she said that first round loss at Wimbledon, I can't remember her exact words, but
it sort of jolted her.
Jolted her, motivated her to sort of try and take her game to the next level. So yeah, I think that's true.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
This edition of the Tennis Podcast is sponsored by Tennis Channel, and Tennis Channel Plus is the place to watch the French Open. They've got every court live, and you can watch on your phone or on your smart TV in HD.
Sounds great. There's genuinely nothing I like more than watching multiple courts with matches everywhere.
And can I just sit and watch court Susan Longlin all day?
You sure can, David. Wherever the stories are, the rivalries emerge and the generations clash, you can watch it all with daily live coverage beginning on Monday, May the 20th. Be there when it happens by subscribing to Tennis Channel Plus to stream daily coverage of Roland Garros. Use promo code TennisPod20 for 20% off your annual subscription. Let's round off the WTA players that we saw today, seeing as we focused on those.
Let's
first
go.
Is it happened?
Well, he said game, set, and match, and on my scores, it's 9-8 from Krakova.
Wow!
So. Sounds like they were
cheering
for the opponent.
The disappointing news I have for you is that I think due to rain,
it's only a second round.
Yeah,
confirmed 10-8 in the
so
tiebreak.
So this probably means she's got to come back at about 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
was that a Colombian player she was up against, which I think might explain why there was such a din?
Are you suggesting they weren't cheering for her?
Oh, they definitely weren't. I was out there earlier.
The Colombian players do get a fantastic amount of support, is my experience. Yeah.
Nothing against from Krakova. It's not personal.
She only needs Matt.
let's talk briefly about Markéta Vondroušová, whose first experience of being in that position. I don't think she'd have been brought for pre-tournament media before.
I think she was there because
she's now a Wimbledon champion. This is her first Grand Slam as a Grand Slam champion, and that was something she was asked about. What are the best and worst things about being a Wimbledon champion? And she said the worst thing is the pressure, which is quite honest of her, I thought, to reveal that that she, you know, the pressure is something she's aware of and something she doesn't like.
Yeah.
A lot of them will go, yeah, I'm aware. The pressure is you guys. It's all you guys think there's pressure, but I'm fine. I'm fine about it.
Yeah, you can see that the status of Grand Slam champion, Wimbledon champion, isn't something that she immediately clicks into and is fine with and is understanding of. That win came as a bit of a shock to her as well. And she loved it. You can see how proud she is. You can see when she talked about her sister and her family, just how much that has meant to them. And I think she could retire tomorrow and be happy with what's happened now. You know, it's one of those results. But obviously, she isn't going to retire tomorrow, and she wants to have a career which has legs in the future. And you kind of have to find a way to manage this new world that you're in. And she's clearly not completely 100% okay with that, but also isn't running away. And I like her. I like the way she comes across in the interview room. And she's already got the tattoo she's had on the coach.
She got it here in New York, I think, was what she implied.
With a date.
She's got the date of the Wimbledon final.
Yeah.
Classic.
Well. Tough for Jabeur to have that date, to know that date is tattooed about someone's person.
Yes, true. And did you see Jabeur said that she had practiced with Vondrosheva before this tournament? And the journalist was like, was that, you know, trying to exorcise the demons? She said, I tried, it did not work.
there's that trauma gif, isn't there?
Yes.
That feels like, trauma.
Yeah. On Jabeur's life right now.
Yeah. She was asked about Frankie the Cat, and she ignored the question, which I really respected.
Yeah, we've done.
Marquesa Vondrosheva is also tired of questions about Frankie, so that's reassuring.
If Frankie were a dog,
I would still find
Great
it a
question.
Bit like. Look, I'd be doing more googling of Frankie, clearly. But I would feel a bit sorry for her still. The whole, like, okay, there's more to this woman than her pet.
Yeah.
Let's find something else.
Yeah, like there's more to your Comte than baking.
Exactly.
That was always the
impression Vondrosheva loved New York. She said she's kind of trying to go with the flow and work with it, but she said it's not for everyone, can be too much sometimes.
Yeah, we do hear that quite a lot.
Mm.
Yeah, and she also wasn't a huge fan of the initiative that they have here, which I think is absolutely great, that, you know, fans can come here and pack out the practice sessions of the big players.
Mm.
And she was like, yeah, quite a lot of people watching my practices.
She didn't love it, did she?
And actually, I was interested to hear about Novak Djokovic's setup generally here.
Yes.
My advice to Vondrosheva would be use the Wimbledon millions to do what Djokovic is doing, which is sort of just have two bases in the most expensive city in the world.
Yeah.
have a city base and have a sprawling New Jersey estate.
Yeah. Have a friend
yeah.
who has an estate that you can live on.
And depending on your mood or your requirement for focus, you can choose where you spend the night.
He has really worked that out over the years, hasn't he, to just fine-tune what goes with his life. And because a lot of the players, Medvedev referenced it as well, is that the city, it's exciting, but it can be a bit too much. It can be tiring, I think, for them. Djokovic has worked out a way to just have his family out, get the buzz of the city, but then just relax in his incredible pad.
Matt had a great question for Djokovic.
That's kind of you.
I don't know how much. I don't think Djokovic lied in the answer. I don't know how much of it was sportsmanship in the answer.
Mm.
Tell us.
What was your question, Matt?
Tell us what happened.
I asked him about the fact that, you know, all throughout his career he's had rivals. He's got this new rival now in Carlos Alcaraz. And when he's in a rivalry like that, how much of his time and attention and sort of focus is on that one specific player, particularly in terms of his training? Like, is he working on stuff to, you know, use against that player in matches? And I suppose I was just kind of thinking of the fact that we always talk about the fact that rivalries are so great because rivals make one another better. And, you know, we think of some of the rivalries we've had recently, and I really don't think it was a coincidence that Roger Federer needed to change his racket and work on his backhand. You know, that felt like a move to try and counter Rafa Nadal. It felt like Rafa Nadal was living in Federer's head and he needed to do something to change that, and he did. And I just wondered whether there was anything in particular about Carlos Alcaraz that has made Novak Djokovic maybe change some of his training methods or work on new things. And, yeah, I mean, he didn't go into detail. He did say that he's definitely keeping an eye on Carlos Alcaraz.
Thing. It was a great question and not a great answer for three quarters of it, and it was a long answer. He tries to help you, but doesn't want to give anything away.
I thought the three quarters were him trying to not disrespect.
Yes.
What we can say,
everyone else,
everybody else, the opponents that he's essentially just dismissing.
Yes.
You know, the incredible draw he has, yeah, that we talked about last,
yeah,
night.
I mean, he did sort of say, you could say I'm so good that I can ignore those first few rounds.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yes, I do say that.
Yeah. The three quarters were him not wanting to be quoted as saying, I'm only focused on playing Carlos Alcaraz in the final, and that's what I'm training for.
Which I really get, and I respect that, actually, that he does care about, yeah, how that comes across. But then he gave you a good little answer, because then he revealed that, yes, my team are watching his matches, and his team are watching my matches, and absolutely, we know, I mean, he didn't say it in as many words, but absolutely, yeah, he's aware of
what the guy's
doing.
His team aren't out there watching Nicholas Jarry's matches. Sorry, Matt.
Jarry,
give it and you take it away.
It's interesting that I'd spent the whole press conference, A, trying to attract the attention of the moderator to be chosen, and I spectacularly failed, and also trying to find a way...
Nobody puts David Law in the corner.
Did them this one.
Today.
Matt Roberts got in ahead of me. And I was also trying to find a way to word my question, which would have been, I think, quite a good follow-up to what you asked. And I was trying to find a way to word it where he wouldn't feel that he was going to disrespect other players by addressing my question about Carlos Alcaraz, which is, if you got to the final, right, and I told you right now you were in the final, you'd obviously be really happy about it. But would you be happier if I told you your opponent is going to be Carlos Alcaraz, or if I told you it was going to be somebody else? Because in theory, the somebody else gives you a better chance to win. But you've got this whole thing going on with Carlos Alcaraz at the moment. So which is it?
What do you think the answer is?
And by the way, that's a great question. And there are several more Novak Djokovic press conferences to come this tournament.
It's a fantastic question.
I think we can get that one in there.
I don't know if he would give an honest answer.
Well, I think he would be really wary of sounding like he's in any way taking anybody else for granted, or disrespecting them, or saying that they're not a threat.
But he's good at talking around
that. He would
that.
Probably do the same thing. He'd give three quarters of an answer of waff. And then get to something.
I think if he had to give you an answer, one or the other, he would want Alcaraz.
I think his dream scenario is winning this US Open, beating Carlos Alcaraz in the final, and he
absolutely
believes thinks he can do that.
It's a risk. It's just higher risk.
Yeah.
It's higher risk,
I think
higher reward.
He'd take the higher risk, I think.
I think so.
At this stage of his career, I think he can absolutely afford to.
If
all he's won.
If he wasn't already on 23...
Yeah, I mean, that might come into it, because
I think if he didn't have the outright Grand Slam lead yet, the answer might be different.
Yeah, I
think he was pretty happy to play Casper Ruud in the French Open final.
Yeah, I mean, he made it clear that he is pumped to be here at the US Open regardless of anybody, but there's no question that Alcaraz has elevated his desire to just get out there and be part of something.
And they're quite happy to be asked about one another.
I think they like each other, and I think that they are, they're buzzing about what they're pushing each other to.
Yeah.
The extremes that they're pushing each other to.
My main impression from Alcaraz's press conference is, you know, most people's default facial expression is just neutral or, you know, arsier than neutral in some people's cases, and then their face can break out into a smile. His default facial expression is smile, and it occasionally breaks out into neutral, but not that often.
And actually, the neutral from Alcaraz came when he was asked about what is it like to be you now in the city here, compared to, say, a year ago, and do you ever get... Because we always talk about how easily he seems to handle the life and not get upset and always seems to be that default happy. But he said, you know, sometimes I would like if I could just be normal and just go out somewhere and, I guess, not be bothered by people. And yet he didn't want to put it in those words because he also clearly loves it and he appreciates it. But it must be a lot to have to deal with. And that was a rare moment of understanding what his life is like and that it's not always great.
Mm. Yeah, he felt ready, though, didn't he? I mean, the first answer he gave was, I'm ready. Then he smiled. I'm practicing well. I'm super excited. Let's get it.
It's a great answer, isn't it?
Says it all.
Yeah. Press conference over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See you in the final in 2 weeks.
we had Daniil Medvedev last up today. It was about an hour ago that we were in his press conference, a little more than that. And he was asked a lot about Djokovic and Alcaraz, wasn't he? And then I asked him whether he was irritated by that at all, or just generally how that made him feel, that they are hogging so much of the limelight in men's tennis at the moment. You emerged on the scene in the... I didn't put this in my question, but you emerged on the scene in the latter stages of the Big Three. There's no longer a Big Three, but there's something else now taking up all the oxygen in the room. Does that bother you? And the answer is emphatically no, David.
Yeah, he's curious himself. He likes watching their rivalry. He thinks it's good for the sport. I think he recognises that he's benefiting from it as well. I don't think he's not enjoying his results against Carlos Alcaraz, that much is clear. But I think he's quietly confident and quietly pumped about the idea of being the party pooper. You asked him the question about being a disruptor, and he was quite happy to go along with the fact that I've done quite well, he said, in that role in the past.
In that role, he said.
You know?
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, actually, if there's something that is going to get Daniil Medvedev's juices flowing, it's the idea of messing all of that vibe and...
Particularly here in New York, where that's how he made his name.
Yeah, I mean, look, he's the guy
who... messing up a vibe.
He's the guy
being a party pooper.
Messed up the calendar slam. Mm, you know?
Yeah.
And he said,
consciously, no, I'm not consciously thinking, yeah, I love being a disruptor. But he said, subconsciously, it probably is there somewhere because I have performed well in that role. And I found that really interesting. And then you, Matt, asked him about, he said, he was quite minimising, wasn't he, of his recent form at the start of the press conference, which I found interesting because that is anomalous for him to have performed as badly relatively as he did in Canada and Cincinnati. I thought he might be more shaken by that.
Yeah, because he's, as you said, he's traditionally had really good results in this time of the season. And watching his matches, I didn't think he was playing that well over the last couple of weeks. And in particular, I didn't think he was serving very well. So I asked him, you know, you said you hadn't been playing great. Was it the serve in particular? And he said yes. Like, the serve sounds like it's been a bit of an issue. He sort of said that everyone goes through a period in their career where they have a bit of an issue with the serve. And it sounded like he's going through that period now. He didn't sort of go into any detail about what the exact issue is. But just from watching his matches, he is hitting a lot of double faults at the moment, like way more than he used to hit. And he said that the serve is the shot which saves you, which I thought was a really interesting expression, because, you know, it's true. Like, if you're not, if the rest of your game's not great, you can at least lean on that serve. And he's not been able to do that in the past couple of weeks because his serve's been troubling him. But he did say he feels like he serves well here at the US Open, and he sort of hopes to get that back. And such a weapon for Medvedev when his serve is working. I don't think of Medvedev as a big server necessarily, but when it's firing, he really can just roll the arm over, hold serve in a minute, and put the pressure back on his opponent. And I think he's lost that ability recently because his serve's been letting him down. So that feels like the sort of pillar of his game that we need to sort of watch out for over the next couple of weeks.
Speaking of serves, we all went to John Isner's final pre-Grand Slam press conference today, and it was really interesting, wasn't it? It was a good time. I've not been to that many John Isner press conferences over the course of my career, but I enjoyed it. And David, you asked him, to be honest, about how he felt about retirement, really realistically, given, you know, you cited the examples of players that are coming out of retirement, players that you might have expected to rock retirement, to be really at peace with it. We're seeing Caroline Wozniacki and Kevin Anderson, two seemingly well-adjusted family men and women, who obviously feel like there's unfinished business, like there's something kicking around in their brains saying, what if? And he was very clear, extremely emphatically clear in this press conference that that's not going to be him. He said he intends to, he doesn't think it's going to be easy. He's under no illusions that there won't be rocky, maybe even dark periods, but he is at peace with the decision. He said he's planning to attack different avenues professionally. And I thought it was very restrained of you, David, with your follow-up, to not specifically press him on whether pickleball is one of those avenues.
I did say, like what?
Yeah.
And he didn't reveal. I mean, he did make the point that, you know, it takes a lot over 17 years to get this body ready for action, because 6'10", 6'11", as he is.
Did you punch the air when he said that?
I did. I felt him. I really did. You know, I mean, I can't do any sporting activity. I find it hard enough getting out of bed, and I'm several inches shorter than he is. But, you know, it is quite an achievement to have a career of that length and give it the battering that he has, and to have kept going for that long. But, yeah, I'm often curious about players calling it a day. You know, he's got a lovely family, and he's obviously made enough money and everything like that. But are you worried about not having this anymore? And when he breaks it down, he said, every day of my last 17 years has been directed into how can I improve? How can I improve on the court, in the gym, even when I'm resting, with designs on being a better tennis player and getting better results? And suddenly you'd no longer have that goal. That is just removed from your life. And in your 30s, for that to be the case, I think a lot of players really struggle mentally with that. He's pumped about getting involved in business initiatives and all sorts of things, and I don't think he'll have any issues really of that type. But he is actually a good talker. I don't always like what he's tweeted over the years, and it was actually quite interesting that his advice would be to not tweet to people. And I was thinking, crikey, you haven't taken your own advice, mate. You know, you're always getting that, and I mean, who am I to talk? You're always getting into it with people.
That's familiar.
But he is a good talker, yeah, in press conferences.
Yeah, and he like all the American men that came through press today, Taylor Fritz, Francis Tiafoe, was asked about the Andy Roddick 20-year anniversary, and one of the moments of the day was Francis Tiafoe's reaction to that question, wasn't it?
Yeah, sort of a really extravagant shake of the head, as if to say, oh God, here we go.
I knew this was coming.
I was going to ask, 20, you know. And it reminds me of Andy Roddick 20 years ago plus, being asked relentlessly about being the follower of Sampras Nagasi. And you know, the first thing Roddick said when he came into his 2003 winning press conference was, no more questions about when's the next American man going to win or the US Open. And because, you know, you forget that he'd been a pro for some 3 years or so, and he'd just been hammered with this stuff relentlessly and not been delivering. That's the thing. And then finally he delivered, and he could just lift that pressure off his shoulders. Tiafoe, his was my favourite press conference of the day. I was curious to see how he would handle coming back now. I still don't necessarily think it will automatically translate on well onto the court, but it translated really well into the interview room. He just is good vibes when he's talking, when he gives you a line. And yeah, I think he's just buzzing about the chance to go out there again. I think this tournament just gets his juices flowing unlike any other. And I suspect we're going to see a different version of him than we've seen all year long.
I thought he gave a fascinating answer explaining the sort of crossroads in his career when he, I guess, became a sort of serious player and a serious sort of top player, where he said when you're so talented and I was like, sure, yeah, you can say that. He said you can rest on that talent and you can just expect it to come, and then when you do that and adversity hits, you're not ready. And he said that he's learned to not do that, and I thought that was kind of summed up the sort of two different halves of Francis Tiafoe's career that we've experienced. And now he's in that bit where he's not resting on his talent anymore. And I think there was a real insight into his relationship with Wayne Ferreira in Breakpoint, and I think Wayne Ferreira has been a sort of
huge,
an important voice and part of that, making him realise that. And I agree with David. I was just taken back to 12 months ago, and I was like, oh, we're with Tiafoe in New York again. The vibes are good. He's talking about wanting everyone to be drunk as hell after 3 p.m. in the crowd and make as much noise as possible. And I'm like, yeah, I want to see that again over the next 2 weeks.
That's a place I want to be transported back to.
Yeah, it's a thing that's been, you know, missing for 12 months. I want to experience it again, and he does desperately.
He also gave an incredible line about Gael Monfils, didn't
he?
Yeah. And an exchange that they had in the locker room. I can't remember exactly what the question was, but he goes, yeah, I was talking about this with Gail last week.
Yeah, Monfils is telling me that you know when I was playing.
He basically said that Gail had said to him that if he were playing now, as in post Big Three era, obviously Djokovic is very much still around, but post
Pac Hunter
era, he'd be cleaning up. That is basically what Tiafoe summarised Monfils' comments as, and Tiafoe was like, whoa there, Gail. There's this Alcaraz guy and Djokovic is more motivated than ever, and he was like, I'm not so sure about that. Hold your horses there. But it was an incredible insight.
Then he did sort of tag on at the end, I am glad I'm playing in the era I'm in. Like, I think he recognises that, you know, as good as Djokovic is now, he's not going to go on for that much longer. And then, obviously, you've got Alcaraz. But Monfils was up against Federer, Nadal and Djokovic in their prime for several years.
It's unfortunate for them all that there's not a gap, isn't there? Like, as brilliant a player as Andy Roddick was, and I was a huge fan of his, he just snuck in time and got that slam and got that world number one, didn't he? If he'd left it 6 months, the Federer stranglehold had begun. There was a window there between Sampras domination and Federer domination. When Carlos Ferrero snapped up a slam, Leighton Hewitt capitalised and had an 18-month period of dominance. Andy Roddick got his slam. Timing is everything, and Alcaraz's precociousness is making it look like there's not the window that I feel like a lot of players next gen, I'm looking at you, have been subconsciously waiting for.
Yeah, I mean, look, obviously I've said 12 in a row.
That's not a window.
So forget it. Everybody, forget it.
Obviously, none of us have done our predictions yet, but just to wrap up our Media Day show, have any of us had any big changes in thoughts about what a player is going to do, how they're going to perform as a result of Media Day? The way
no,
that we sometimes
I haven't,
do.
Actually, the one player I did want to speak to and try and get a sense of is Elena Rybakina, who didn't come in today. I'm not quite sure why.
There's always a couple of stragglers, isn't there?
Yeah.
And David might be cleaning up those stragglers while Matt and I are
on the road,
on some sort of highway en route to Foxborough, Massachusetts tomorrow. Yeah, Andy Murray's due in tomorrow. I hope Elena Rybakina is down to come, but don't know.
Yeah, like she's my big unknown, yeah. I suppose, in the women's draw. But no, honestly, I didn't. I don't have concrete feelings about who I think is going to win this tournament.
It is a requirement of your role on this podcast to
I will come up with some.
Just produce some concrete feelings.
I think everybody's feels burnt after last year being convinced that Iga Świątek had let us in on how she hated the city and she's got no chance. Then she goes and wins it.
I'm burned by everything. I'm nothing but predictions trauma at this point. Wow, two more days till it all gets going, and there's the very real possibility that qualifying will be taking place right up until it's going to go right up to the wire. I mean, weather permitting, they should, if the rain holds off tonight, be able to get the second round matches completed so that they can play all of the third round qualifying matches tomorrow when the forecast is good. But it feels like there could be rain still in the air.
It has been like a Solihull September day.
It's going to get better, David.
Day after day,
it
really
is going to get better. I promise you that. We
Thank
start
you.
With our daily podcasts from Monday. 14 of them, folks. And then we'll have our review show and our Q&A show for friends of the tennis podcast in the aftermath of the final Grand Slam of the year. But our next regular show will be Monday, our first show of the 2023 US Open. Before that, we're going to do a live show on Sunday, hopefully here from the US Open, pending permissions. TBC on that, but that's plan
TBC.
A. Plan B is great too, if those permissions don't come through in time, don't worry. But that is the hope. We'll be with you. Do we want to set a time?
Hadn't thought about that. Sometime in the afternoon our time, evening UK.
Keep across our socials. I'm going to suggest it's going to be mid-afternoon US time on Sunday. 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, something like that.
Sounds believable.
Yeah, keep across our socials for exact confirmation, but that's the plan for Sunday. I know a few of you have been in touch to say they're disappointed that that show won't be available as a podcast. This is an extra, folks. It's not a show that would have been a podcast, that we're taking away from people that aren't interested in video shows. The podcasts are untouched. This is a bonus for anybody that particularly enjoys seeing our faces.
Bocco.
It is the very definition, folks, of Bocco. So watch this space for exact timings, and we'll be with you on Sunday for a live YouTube show. And then, of course, it all kicks off in earnest on Monday, brought to you in association with AO Travel throughout the fortnight, and also with Willow, our US Open mascot. I'm looking at some pictures of Willow on her Instagram page, which is an absolute treat. Willow Cucumber is apparently her surname, and she's an absolute delight. So thank you, Willow, for being our US Open mascot. Oh my god, goodness, I wish I hadn't just logged into Instagram. Some Sitsidosa content was sprung upon me. what else? We have our mascots. I've got Xenia, Matt's got Darwin, and David has Maisie.
Amazing.
Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King. and Alana Kloss. We have our top folks and executive producers, Jamie, Hannah and Drew. Thanks to you all. And Matt, we have shout outs.
We start with Kim Ferguson in Glasgow.
Hey.
That is an excellent Scottish name, Kim Ferguson.
Like Clysters, who was the subject of our recent Tennis Relived, which is still available for you now if you are a friend of the Tennis Podcast.
Absolutely. There's only one Tennis Kim, isn't there?
Yes, can't think of any others.
It's not Kim Birrell.
Tennis Kim, but not quite so
but
well
not
known.
The Tennis Kim.
Thank you, Kim.
We've also got Mark Savitsky, who is in Sydney.
Hello, Mark.
Right, Mark.
Mark actually comes up with his own tennis mark. He says, once when working for ATP Fan Fest at White City in the late 90s, I played mini tennis with my namesake, Mark Rosse.
Oh, Mark Rosse.
Is this Mark also Mark with a C?
He does point out the different spelling.
Same church, different pew.
Exactly.
Mark Rosse, who was sitting on the Wimbledon roof whilst I was trying to steal the picnic table that he was sat at so that we could get undercover. And he just didn't move, so I had to go somewhere else.
Mark Rosse, who I interviewed during the pandemic and who called me back to deliver an addendum.
Oh, that was good, wasn't it?
That was a great moment.
What was the addendum about? It was about the 1980s
Olympics. It was Olympics relived,
wasn't it? 1992 Olympics that he won. And yes, I can't quite remember what the addendum
was. I think he just felt like he hadn't quite
got to the heart of it, or
done it justice.
Yeah.
And he wanted to give you a little bit more.
That has never happened to me before, that an interviewee has called me
it's
back.
It's never happened to me since. Thank you, Mark.
Yes.
And finally, we have Alan Owl. And ooh. Alan says, last name is pronounced like you hurt yourself.
Really appreciate that.
It's very helpful.
Guidance, yeah. Alan.
Cheers, Alan.
Alan
Mills, the former Wimbledon referee.
Of lifting the covers fame.
Yes, absolutely. And who once referee.
He adjudicated our end of year awards.
Yes.
We've come a long way since then.
I think that was fantastic content.
It was. It was great.
It's the best pre-match content we've ever
had. Wasn't that at the Albert Hall?
Yes.
It was. Yeah.
I was there.
Oh.
But it was very much pre-me. I was there, but I wasn't.
Right.
But I remember that happening.
Thank you, Alan. Thank you also to all of our friends of the Tennis Podcast at whatever level, because without you we wouldn't be here in New York. This is an expensive city first. and we're very glad to be here covering this tournament, but it absolutely, even with our sponsors and people that back the show in the way they do on a corporate level, and we're very grateful for them, even with those, we would not be able to be here if it weren't for friends of the Tennis Podcast. So we thank you. We will do our best to deliver you top-notch boco as we always try to. And if you would like to become a friend of the Tennis Podcast and get access to that content and support us in what we do year round, the link to do that, as always, is in our show notes, as is the link to subscribe to our newsletter, which is just a reminder for you daily during the slams, and it's excellent. So without further ado, I will leave you for a full 48 hours, and I'll remind you that we'll be back on Monday with our first US Open 2023 daily show, and we'll be back on Sunday, exact time TBC, with our live YouTube show. We will see you and speak to you soon.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.